Chapter 22. Out of Thin Air.
The Amhara market was one of three in Farmatting where foreigners were allowed to trade, but despite the name, the huge square had nothing of the look of a market, no market stalls or displays of merchandise. A few mounted riders, a handful of closed sedan chairs carried by brightly liveried bearers, and the occasional coach with its window curtains drawn, made their way through a sparse yet bustling crowd that might have been seen in any large city. Most were well wrapped in their cloaks against the morning winds blowing in off the lake that surrounded the city, and it was the cold that made them hurry more than any urgent business. Around the square, as at the city's other two strangers' markets, the tall stone houses of bankers rubbed shoulders with slate-roofed stone inns where the foreign merchants stayed, and blocky windowless stone warehouses where their goods were stored, all jumbled in among stone stables and stone-walled wagon yards. Farmatting was a city of stone walls and slate roofs. This time of year, the inns were a quarter full at best, and the warehouses and wagon yards emptier than that. Come spring and the full revival of trade, though, merchants would pay triple for whatever space they could find. A round marble pedestal in the center of the square held a statue of Savion Amhara, two spans tall and proud in her fur-trimmed robes of marble, with elaborate marble chains of office around her neck. Her marble face was stern beneath the First Council's jeweled marble diadem, and her right hand firmly gripped the hilt of a marble sword, its point resting between her slippered feet, while her raised left hand aimed a warning marble finger toward the tier gate some three-quarters of a mile away. Farmatting depended on merchants from Tyr and Ilion and Camelon, but the High Council was ever wary of foreigners and their corrupting outland ways. One of the steel-capped street guards, in a leather coat sewn with overlapping square metal plates and a golden hand on his left shoulder, stood below the statue, using a long, limber pole to frighten away black-winged gray pigeons. Savion Amhara was one of the three most revered women in Farmatting's history, though none was known very far beyond the lake's shores. Two men from the city were mentioned in every history of the world, though it had been called Aran Madar when one was born, and Fel Morina for the other. But Farmatting did its fervent best to forget Rowlan Darksbane and Urien Stonebow. In a real way, those two men were why Rand was in Farmatting. A few people in the Amhara glanced at him as he passed, yet nobody glanced twice. That he was from off was plain enough, with his blue eyes and his hair cut at the shoulder. Men here wore it sometimes hanging all the way down to the waist, either tied at the nape of the neck or held with a clip. His plain brown woolens were nondescript, though, no better than a moderately successful merchant might wear. And he was not the only one cloakless, in spite of the lake winds. Most of the others were fork-beard Kandori, or Arafelan, with belled braids, or hawk-nosed Saldaeans, men and women who found this weather mild compared to borderland winter, but nothing about him said he was not a borderlander, too. For his part, he simply refused to let the cold touch him, ignored it as he might have a fly buzzing. A cloak might get in his way if he found his chance to act. For once, even his height did not attract notice. There were a good many very tall men in Farmatting, few of them natives. Manel Rochide himself was only a hand shorter than Rand, if that. Rand stayed well behind the man, letting people and sedan chairs sift between them and sometimes even hide his quarry. With his hair dyed black by herbs Nynaeve had provided, he doubted that the renegade Ashaman would notice him, even if the man turned around. For his part, he was not worried about losing Rochide. Most of the local men wore dull colors, with brighter embroidery about the chest and shoulders, and perhaps a jeweled hair clip for the more prosperous, while the outland merchants favored sober, unpretentious clothes, so as not to seem overly wealthy, and their guards and drivers bundled themselves in rough woolens. Rochide's bright red silk coat stood out. He strode across the square like a king, one hand resting lightly on the hilt of his sword, a fur-edged cloak billowing behind him in the wind. He was a fool. That flapping cloak and the sword alike drew eyes. His waxed and curled mustaches named him a Mirandian, who should be shivering like any normal human being, and that sword, a pure bull goose fool.
"You are the fool coming to this place,"
Luz Theron panted wildly in his head.
"Madness! Madness! We have to get out! We have to!"
Ignoring the voice, Rand pulled his snug gloves tighter and kept a steady pace after Rochide. A number of the street guards in the square were watching the man. Foreigners were considered troublemakers and hotheads, and Mirandians had a prickly reputation. A foreigner carrying a sword always attracted the guard's attention. Rand was glad he had decided to leave his at the inn with Min. She nestled in the back of his head more strongly than Elaine or Avienda or Alana. He was only vaguely aware of the others. Min seemed alive inside him. As Rochide left the Amhara, heading deeper into the city, flights of pigeons sprang up from the rooftops, but instead of making the unerring swoops that normally would have taken them into the sky, birds crashed into one another, and some tumbled, fluttering to the pavement. People gaped, including the street guards who had been watching Rochide so intently a moment before. The man did not look back, but it would not have mattered had he seen. He knew Rand was in the city without seeing the effects of a Taviran, or he would not have been there. Following Rochide onto the Street of Joy, really two broad straight streets, separated by a measured row of leafless, gray-barked trees, Rand smiled. Rochide and his friends probably thought themselves very clever. Perhaps they had found the map of the northern plains of Moreto replaced upside down in the racks in the Stone of Tyr, or the book on cities of the south, misshelved in the library of the Ais Daishar Palace in Chachin, or one of the other hints he had left behind. Small mistakes a man in a hurry might make, but any two or three together painted an arrow pointing to Far Matting. Rochide and the others had been quick to see it, quicker than he had expected, or else they had had help to point it out. Either way, it did not matter. He was not sure why the Mirandian had come ahead of the others, but he knew they would come, Torval and Dashiva, Gedwin and Kisman, to try finishing what they had bungled in Kyrian. A pity none of the Forsaken would be fool enough to come after him here. They would just send the others. He wanted to kill Rochide before the rest arrived, if he could. Even here, where they were all on an equal footing, it would be best to cut down the odds. 2 days Rochide had been in Far Matting, openly asking questions about a tall, red-haired man, swaggering about as if he had not a worry in the world. The man had seen any number who more or less met his description, but he still thought he was the hunter, not the hunted.
"You've brought us here to die," Luz Theron moaned. "Being here is as bad as death."
Rand shrugged uncomfortably. He agreed with the voice about that last. He would be as glad as Luz Theron to leave. But sometimes the only choice was between bad and worse. Rochide was ahead of him, almost within reach. That was all that mattered now. The greystone shops and inns along the Street of Joy changed the farther Rand went from the Amhara market. Silversmiths replaced cutlers, and then goldsmiths replaced silversmiths. Seamstresses and tailors displayed embroidered silks and brocades instead of woolens. The coaches that rumbled over the paving stones now had sigils lacquered on the doors and teams of 4 or 6 matched for size and color, and more riders were mounted on prime Tyran bloodstock or animals as good. Sedan chairs borne by trotting bearers became almost as common as people afoot, and afoot, shopkeepers in coats or dresses heavily embroidered around the chest and shoulders were outnumbered by folk in livery as bright as that of the chair-bearers. Often as not, bits of colored glass now decorated men's hair clips, or occasionally pearls or richer gems, though few men walked whose wives could afford gems. Only the cold wind was the same, that and the street guards patrolling in threes, eyes alert for trouble. There were not so many as in the strangers' markets, yet as soon as one patrol strode out of sight, another appeared, and wherever a street wider than an alleyway met the Street of Joy, a stone watch stand stood with two guardsmen waiting at the foot in case the man atop spotted trouble. The piece was kept rigorously in formatting. Rand frowned as Rochide kept on along the street. Could he be headed for the council's plaza in the middle of the island? There was nothing there but the Hall of the Councils, monuments from more than 500 years earlier, when Farmatting had been the capital of Moredo, and the counting houses of the city's wealthiest women. In Farmatting, a wealthy man was one whose wife gave him a generous allowance, or a widower who had been provided for. Maybe Rochide was meeting dark friends. But if so, why had the man waited? Suddenly a wave of dizziness hit him, a murky face filling his vision for an instant, and he staggered against a passerby. Taller than Rand himself, in bright green livery, the yellow-haired man shifted the large basket he was carrying and fended Rand off gently. A long, puckered scar ran down the side of his sun-dark face. Bowing his head, he murmured an apology and hurried on. Righting himself, Rand growled a curse under his breath.
"You destroyed them already," Luz Theron whispered in his head. "Now you have someone else to destroy, and not before time. How many will we three kill before the end, I wonder?"
"Shut up," Rand thought fiercely, but cackling derisive laughter answered him. It was not the encounter with an Aielman that upset him. He had seen many since coming to Farmatting. For some reason, hundreds of the Aiel who fled after learning the truth of their history had ended up there, attempting to follow the way of the leaf when they had no more idea of what that entailed except that they were supposed to be lifelong Gaishine. He was not even worried about the dizziness or whose face it was that he half saw when it struck. Ahead of him, a coach drawn by 6 greys clattered through the stream of sedan chairs and hurrying folk in livery, and men and women darting in and out of the shops. But there was no sign of a red coat. He smacked a gloved fist into his palm in irritation. Going ahead blindly was idiotic. He might run right into the man, or at least be seen. So far, Rochide thought Rand did not know he was in the city, an advantage too important to squander. He knew where Rochide had his rooms, one of the inns that catered to foreign men. He could loiter outside tomorrow and wait for another chance. The others might arrive in the night, too. He thought he could kill any 2 together, or maybe even all 5. But it could not be done quietly. He would take injuries against 5, and at best he would have to abandon his sword, which he was reluctant to do. It was a gift from Avienda. At worst, a flicker of fur-trimmed cloak caught his eye, fluttering in the wind as it vanished around a corner ahead, and he ran toward it. The guardsman at the watchstand there straightened, the man at the top taking his rattle from his belt. One of those at the bottom of the stand hefted his long cudgel, while the other lifted a catch-pole from where it had leaned against the watchstand's steps. The forked end was fashioned to catch and hold an arm, or a leg, or a neck, and the pole itself was belted with iron, proof against any sword or axe. They watched him closely with hard eyes. He nodded to them and smiled, then ostentatiously peered down the side street, searching the crowd there. Not a running thief, just a man trying to catch up to someone. The cudgel went back onto its belt hook, the catchpole returned to the steps. He did not look at the guardsman again. Ahead he got a glimpse of the cloak, and maybe a red coat, as the wearer turned onto another street. Raising his hand as if to hail somebody, Rand sped after the man, dodging between people and street peddlers' barrows. Hawkers displaying pins or needles or combs on their trays tried to catch his attention, or anyone's, with their cries. Few people here wore embroidery, and a simple cord tying a man's hair was much more common than even the plainest clip. These streets were cramped at best, and crooked, a haphazard maze where cheap inns and narrow stone apartment buildings of 3 and 4 stories towered over the shops of butchers and candlemakers and barbers, tinsmiths and potters and coopers. Coaches would not have fit along these streets, and there were no sedan chairs either, no riders, and only a handful of liveried servants carrying baskets on errands but strolling and looking down their noses at everyone around them, except the street guards. Their patrols and watchstands were present even here. At last he got near enough for a clear view of the man he was following. Rochide had finally shown enough sense to pull his cloak about him, hiding his red coat and his useless sword, but there was no doubt of who he was. In truth, he seemed to be trying to avoid notice altogether now, slinking along the side of the street with his shoulder brushing the shop fronts. Abruptly, he looked around furtively, then darted into an alley between a tiny basket weaver's shop and an inn, with a sign so dirty the name was completely obscured. Rand almost grinned, and wasted no time hurrying after him. There were no street guards or watchstands in Farmadding's alleyways. Those alleys were even more crooked than the streets Rand had just left, making a warren of their own through the interior of every block of the city, and Rochide was already out of sight. But Rand could hear his boots pounding on the damp, stony dirt. The sound bounced and multiplied between the windowless stone walls until he could hardly tell where it was coming from. But he followed, running along passages barely wide enough for two men abreast, if they were friendly. Why had Rochide come into this maze? Wherever he was going, he wanted to be there quickly. But he could not know how to use the alleys to get from one place to another. Abruptly, Rand realized the only boots he was hearing were his own and stopped dead. Silence. From where he stood, he could see three more narrow alleys splitting off from the one he stood in. Barely breathing, he strained his ears. Silence. Almost, he decided to turn back. And then he heard a distant clatter from the nearest alley mouth, as though someone had accidentally kicked a rock against a stone wall in passing. Best to kill the man and be done. Rand turned the corner into the alley and found Rochide waiting for him. The Mirandian had his cloak thrown back again, and both hands on his sword hilt. The Farmadding peace bond wove Hilton's scabbard inside a net of fine wire. He wore a small, knowing smile. "You were as easy to bait as a pigeon," he said, beginning to draw his sword. The wires had been cut, then fixed, so they still appeared solid to a casual glance. "Run, if you want." Rand did not run. Instead, he stepped forward, slamming his left hand down on the end of Rochide's sword hilt, trapping the blade still half in its scabbard. Surprise widened the man's eyes, yet he still did not realize that pausing to gloat had already killed him. He moved back, trying to get room to complete his draw, but Rand followed smoothly, keeping the sword trapped and pivoted from the hips, driving folded knuckles hard into Rochide's throat. Cartilage cracked loudly, and the renegade forgot about trying to kill anyone. Staggering backwards, wide-eyed and staring, he clapped both hands to his throat and desperately tried to pull air through his ruined windpipe. Rand was already beginning the killing stroke, beneath the breastbone, when a whisper of sound came to him from behind, and suddenly Rochide's taunting took on new meaning. Back-heeling Rochide, Rand let himself fall to the ground atop the man. Hard-swung metal clanged against a stone wall, and a man cursed. Grabbing Rochide's sword, Rand let the motion of falling turn into a roll, pulling the blade clear as he tumbled over his own shoulder. Rochide gave a shrill, gurgling scream as Rand came up in a crouch, facing back the way he had come. Rafar Kisman stood gaping down at Rochide, the blade he had meant to stab through Rand instead driven into Rochide's chest. Blood bubbled on the Mirandian's lips, and he dug his heels into the ground and bloodied his hands in the sharp steel as though he could push it out of him. Of only average height and pale for a Tyran, Kisman wore clothes as plain as Rand's, except for the sword belt. Hiding that beneath his cloak, he could have gone anywhere in Farmadding without being noticed. His dismay lasted only an instant. As Rand rose, sword ready in both hands, Kisman jerked his own blade free and did not look at his thrashing accomplice again. He watched Rand, and his hands shifted nervously on the long hilt of his sword. No doubt he was one of those so proud of being able to use the power as a weapon that he had disdained really learning the sword. Rand had not disdained. Rochide gave a last twitch and was still, staring up at the sky. "Time to die," Rand said quietly, But as he started forward, a rattle sounded somewhere behind the Tyran, an incessant chattering, and then another. The street guards.
"They'll take us both," Kismin breathed, sounding frantic. "If they find us standing over a corpse, they'll hang us both. You know they will."
He was right, at least in part. If the guards found them there, they would be hauled off to the cells beneath the Hall of the Councils. More rattles chattered, coming closer. The guards must have noticed three men ducking one by one into the same alley. Perhaps they had even seen Kismin's sword. Reluctantly, Rand nodded. The Tyran backed away cautiously, and when he saw Rand making no move to follow, he sheathed his blade and ran wildly, dark cloak flaring behind him. Rand threw his borrowed sword down atop Rochide's body and ran the other way. There were no rattles in that direction yet. With luck, he could be out into the streets, blending into the crowds before he was seen. He had other fears than the noose. Stripping off his gloves, showing the dragons that marked his arms would be enough to prevent his hanging, he was sure. But the councils had proclaimed their acceptance of that odd decree Elida had issued. Once he was in a cell, he would remain there until the White Tower sent for him. So he ran as hard as he could. Melting into the crowd in the street, Kismin heaved a sigh of relief as three street guards ran into the alley he had just emerged from. Holding his cloak close to hide his scabbarded sword, he moved with the flow of traffic no faster than anyone else, and slower than some. Nothing to draw a guardsman's eye. A pair of them passed with a trussed prisoner stuffed into a large sack, slung from a quarterstaff, carried on their shoulders. Only the man's head stuck out, his eyes wild and darting. Kismin shuddered. Burn his eyes, that could have been him. Him! He had been a fool to let Rochide talk him into this in the first place. They were supposed to wait until everyone had arrived, slipping into the city one by one to avoid notice. Rochide had wanted the glory of being the one to kill Althor. The Mirandian had burned with the desire to prove himself a better man than Althor. Now he was dead of it, and very nearly Rhaefar Kismin with him. And that made Kismin furious. He wanted power, more than glory, perhaps to rule Tyr from the stone, perhaps more. He wanted to live forever. Those things had been promised. They were his due. Part of his anger was because he was unsure they actually were supposed to kill Althor. The Great Lord knew he wanted to. He would not sleep soundly until the man was dead and buried. And yet...
"Kill him,"
the Mihail had ordered before sending them to Cairhien, but he had been as displeased that they were found out as that they had failed. Far Matting was to be their last chance. He had made that as plain as polished brass. Dashiva had simply vanished. Kismin did not know whether he had run or the Mihail had killed him, and he did not care.
"Kill him,"
Demondred had commanded later, but he had added that it would be better they died than let themselves be discovered again. By anyone, even the Mihail, as if he did not know of Taim's order. And later still, Moradin had said, "Kill him, if you must, but above all, bring everything in his possession to me. That will redeem your previous transgressions." The man said he was one of the chosen, and no one was mad enough to make that claim unless it was true, yet he seemed to think Althor's belongings more important than his death. The killing incidental and not really necessary. Those two were the only chosen Kismin had met, but they made his head hurt. They were worse than Cairhienin. He suspected that what they left unsaid could kill a man quicker than a signed order from a High Lord. Well, once Torval and Gedwin arrived, they could work out... Abruptly, something stung his right arm, and he stared down in consternation at the bloodstain spreading on his cloak. It did not feel like a deep cut, and no cut purse would have slashed his forearm. "He belongs to me," a man whispered behind him. But when he turned, there was only the crowd in the street, all going about their business. The few who noticed the dark stain on his cloak looked away quickly. In this place, no one wanted to be associated with even the smallest violence. They were good at ignoring what they did not want to see. The wound throbbed, burning more than it had at first. Releasing his cloak to the wind, Gizmon pressed his left hand over the bloody slash in his sleeve. His arm felt swollen to his touch and hot. Suddenly he stared in horror at his right hand, stared as it turned as black and bloated as a week-old corpse. Frantically he began to run, pushing people out of his way, knocking them down. He did not know what was happening to him, how it had been done, but he was sure of the result. Unless he could get out of the city, beyond the lake, up into the hills. He had a chance then. A horse. He needed a horse. He had to have a chance. He had been promised he would live forever. All he could see were people afoot, and they were scattering before his charge. He thought he heard guardsmen's rattles, but it might have been the blood pounding in his ears. Everything was going dark. His face hit something hard, and he knew he had fallen. His last thought was that one of the Chosen had decided to punish him. But for what, he could not have said. Only a few men were sitting at the round tables in the common room of the Crown of Moreto when Rand walked in. Despite the grand name, it was a modest inn with 24 rooms on 2 floors above. The plastered walls of the common room were painted yellow, and the men serving table here wore long yellow aprons. A stone fireplace at either end of the room gave it a marked warmth after outside. The shutters were bolted, but lamps hung on the walls took the edge off the dimness. The smells drifting from the kitchens promised a tasty midday meal of fish from the lake. Rand would be sorry to miss that. The cooks at the Crown of Moreto were very good. He saw Lan at a table by himself against the wall. The braided leather cord that held Lan's hair back drew sidelong glances from some of the other men, but he refused to give up wearing the hadori, even for a little while. He met Rand's gaze, and when Rand nodded toward the stairs at the back of the room, he did not waste time with questioning looks. He just set down his wine cup and rose, starting for the stairs. Even with just a small knife at his belt, he looked dangerous, but there was nothing to be done about that either. Several men at the tables glanced Rand's way, but for some reason they looked away hurriedly when he met their eyes. Near the kitchen, at the door to the women's room, Rand stopped. Men were not allowed in there. Aside from a few flowers painted on the yellow walls, the women's room was not much fancier than the common room, though the stand lamps were painted yellow too, and the facings of the fireplace. The yellow aprons worn by the women who served table here were no different than those worn by the men in the common room. Mistress Nalhera, the slim, gray-haired innkeeper, was sitting at the same table as Min, Nynaeve, and Olivia, all of them chatting and laughing over tea. Rand's jaw tightened at the sight of the former Demani. Nynaeve claimed the woman had insisted on coming along, but he did not believe anyone could insist on anything with Nynaeve. She wanted Olivia along for some secret reason. She had been behaving mysteriously, as though working as hard as she could at being Aes Sedai, ever since he went back for her after leaving Elaine. All three women had adopted high-necked farm-matting dresses, heavily embroidered with flowers and birds in the bodice and shoulders and right up to their chins, though sometimes Nynaeve grumbled over them. No doubt she would have preferred stout Two Rivers woolens to the finer materials she found here. On the other hand, if the red dot of the Kaisine on her forehead were not enough to draw every eye, she had decked herself out in jewelry as though attending a royal audience. A slim golden belt and a long necklace and any number of bracelets, all but one set with bright blue sapphires and polished green stones he did not know, and every finger on her right hand had a ring to match. Her great serpent ring was tucked away somewhere so as not to attract attention, but the rest drew 10 times as much. Many people would not have known an Aes Sedai's ring at sight, but anyone could see money in those gems. Rand cleared his throat and bent his head. "Wife, I need to speak with you upstairs," he said, remembering at the last moment to add, "if it pleases you." He could not make it more urgent than that, not to maintain the proprieties, but he hoped they did not linger. They might, if only to demonstrate for the innkeeper that they were not at his beck and call. For some reason, people in Farmatting actually seem to believe that women from off jumped when men told them to. Min twisted around in her chair to grin at him, the way she did every time he called her wife. The feel of her in his head was warmth and delight, suddenly sparkling with amusement. She found their situation in Farmatting very amusing. Leaning toward Mistress Nalhera, without taking her eyes from him, she said something in a low voice that made the older woman cackle with laughter and gave Nynaeve a pained expression. Olivia stood up, looking nothing like the subdued woman he vaguely remembered handing over to Taim. All those captured Suldam and Damani had been a burden he was glad to be free of. No more. There were threads of white in her golden hair and fine lines at the corners of her eyes, but those eyes were fierce now. "Well," she drawled, staring down at Nynaeve, but somehow she made the word both a criticism and a command. Nynaeve glared up at the woman and took her sweet time in standing and smoothing her skirts, but at least she stood. Rand waited no longer before rushing upstairs. Lan was waiting at the head of the stairs, just out of sight of the common room below. Quietly, Rand gave a bare-bones account of what had happened. Lan's stony face never changed expression.
"At least one of them is done," he said, turning toward the room he shared with Nynaeve. "I'll get our things ready."
Rand was already in the room he and Min shared, hurriedly pulling their clothes out of the tall wardrobe and stuffing them any way they would go into one of the wicker pack hampers, when she finally entered the room, followed by Nynaeve and Olivia.
"Light, you'll ruin our things that way," Min exclaimed,
shouldering him away from the hamper. She began removing garments and folding them neatly on the bed beside his peace-bonded sword.
"Why are we packing?" she asked,
but gave him no chance to answer.
"Mistress Nalhera says you wouldn't be so sulky if I switched you every morning."
She laughed, shaking out one of the coats she did not wear here. He had told her he would buy her new, but she refused to leave the embroidered coats and breeches behind.
"I told her I'd consider it. She likes Lan very much."
Suddenly she pitched her voice high in imitation of the innkeeper.
"A neat, mild-mannered man is much to be preferred over a pretty face, I always say."
Nynaeve snorted.
"Who wants a man she can make jump through hoops whenever she likes?"
Rand stared at her, and Min's mouth fell open. That was exactly what Nynaeve did to Lan, and how the man put up with it was more than Rand could understand.
"You think about men too much, Nynaeve," Olivia drawled.
Nynaeve frowned, but instead of saying anything, she just stood there fingering one of her bracelets, a peculiar piece with flat golden chains stretching down the back of her left hand to rings on all four fingers. The older woman shook her head as though disappointed at not getting a rise.
"I'm packing because we have to go and be quick about it," Rand said hastily.
Nynaeve might be quiet for the moment, odd as that was, but if her face got any darker, she would be yanking her braid and shouting till no one could get a word in edgewise for hours. Before he finished the same account he had given Lan, Min stopped folding things and started replacing her books in the second hamper, hurriedly enough that she did not pad them with cloaks the way she usually did. The other two women stood staring at him as though they had never seen him before. In case they were not being as quick to see as Min, he impatiently added,
"Rochaid and Kismin ambushed me. They knew I was following. Kismin got away. If he knows this inn, he and Dashiva and Gedwin and Torval might all turn up here. Maybe in 2 or 3 days, or maybe in an hour or so."
"I am not blind," Nynaeve said, still staring at him. There was no heat in her voice. Was she protesting just for the form of it? "If you want to hurry, help Min instead of standing around like a woolhead."
She stared at him a moment longer and shook her head before leaving. Olivia paused in the act of following and glared at Rand. No, there was nothing subdued about her any longer.
"You could get yourself killed like that," she said disapprovingly. "You have too much to do to get killed yet. You must let us help."
He frowned at the door closing behind her.
"Have you had any viewings about her, Min?"
"All the time, but not the kind you mean. Nothing I understand."
She wrinkled her nose at one of the books and set it aside. Small chance she would abandon a single volume of her not-so-small library. Undoubtedly she meant to carry that one and read it at the first opportunity. She spent hours with her nose in those books.
"Rand," she said slowly, "you did all that. Killed one man and faced another, and... Rand, I didn't feel anything. In the bond, I mean. No fear, no anger, not even concern, nothing."
"I wasn't angry with him." Shaking his head, he began shoveling clothes into the hamper again. "He just needed killing, that's all. And why would I be afraid?"
"Oh," she said in a small voice. "I see."
She bent back to the books. The bond had gone very still, as if she were deep in thought, but there was a troubled thread worming through the stillness. "Min, I promise I won't let anything happen to you." He did not know whether he could keep that promise, but he intended to try. She smiled at him, almost laughing. Light, she was beautiful.
"I know that, Rand. And I won't let anything happen to you."
Love flowed along the bond like the blaze of a noonday sun.
"Olivia's right, though. You do have to let us help somehow. If you describe these fellows well enough, maybe we can ask questions. You certainly can't search the whole city alone."
"We are dead men," Luz Theron murmured. "Dead men should be quiet in their graves, but they never are."
Rand barely heard the voice in his head. Suddenly he knew he did not have to describe Kismen and the others. He could draw them so well that anyone would recognize the faces. Except he had never been able to draw in his life. Luz Theron could, though. That should have frightened him. It should have. Isam paced the room, studying by the ever-present light of Telaionriad. The bed linens shifted from rumpled to neatly made between one glance and the next. The coverlet changed from flowered to plain dark red to quilted. The ephemeral always changed here, and he barely noticed any more. He could not use Telaionriad the way the Chosen could, but here was where he felt most free. Here he could be who he wanted to be. He chuckled at the thought. Stopping beside the bed, he carefully unsheathed the two poisoned daggers and stepped out of the unseen world into the waking. As he did, he became Luke. It seemed appropriate. The room was dark in the waking world, but the single window let in sufficient moonlight for Luke to make out the mounded shapes of two people lying asleep beneath their blankets. Without hesitation, he drove a blade into each. They woke with small cries, but he pulled the blades free and drove them in again and again. With the poison, it was unlikely either would have had the strength to shout loudly enough to be heard outside the room. But he wanted to make this kill his own in a way that poison could not grant. Soon they stopped twitching when he thrust a blade between ribs. Wiping the daggers clean on the coverlet, he resheathed them with as much care as he had drawn them. He had been given many gifts, but immunity to poison or any other weapon was not among them. Then he took a short candle from his pocket and blew away enough ash from the banked coals in the fireplace to light the wick. He always liked to see the people he killed after, if he could not during. He had especially enjoyed those two Aes Sedai in the Stone of Tyr. The incredulity on their faces when he appeared out of thin air, the horror when they realized he had not come to save them, were treasured memories. That had been Isam, not him, but the memories were nonetheless prized for that. Neither of them got to kill an Aes Sedai very often. For a moment he studied the faces of the man and woman on the bed, then pinched out the candle's flame and returned the candle to his pocket before stepping back into Telaionriad. His patron of the moment was waiting for him. A man, he was sure of that much, but Luke could not look at him. It was not as it was with those slimy gray men
whom you just did not notice. He had killed one of them once, in the White Tower itself. They felt cold and empty to the touch. It had been like killing a corpse. No, this man had done something with the power, so Luke's eyes slid away from him like water sliding down glass. Even seen at the corner of the eye, he was a blur.
"The pair sleeping in this room will sleep forever," Luke said. "But the man was bald, the woman gray."
"A pity," the man said, and the voice seemed to melt in Luke's ears. He would not be able to recognize it if he heard it without the disguise. The man had to be one of the Chosen. Few save the Chosen knew how to reach him, and none of the men among those few could channel, or would have dared trying to command him. His services were always begged, except by the Great Lord himself, and more recently by the Chosen, but none of the Chosen Luke had met had ever taken such precautions as this.
"Do you want me to try again?" Luke asked.
"Perhaps. When I tell you. Not before. Remember, not a word of this to anyone."
"As you command," Luke replied, bowing,
but the man was already making a gateway, a hole that opened into a snowy forest glade. He was gone before Luke straightened. It really was a pity. He had rather looked forward to killing his nephew and the wench. But if there was time to pass, hunting was always a pleasure. He became Esom. Esom liked killing wolves even more than Luke did.